Richard realized with surprise that the man could see them, and also that he was doing his best to pretend that he couldn't. The Marquis stopped in front of him. The wail of the saxophone trailed off in a nervous squeak. The Marquis flashed a cold grin. "It's Lear, isn't it?" he asked. The man nodded warily. His fingers stroked the keys of his saxophone. "We're after Earl's Court," continued the Marquis. "Would you happen to have such a thing as a train timetable about your person?" Richard was beginning to catch on. He assumed that the Earl's Court, to which he referred, wasn't the familiar tube station he had waited in innumerable times, reading a paper or just daydreaming. The man named Lear moistened his lips with the tip of his tongue. "'S not impossible. What'd be in it for me, if I did?" The Marquis thrust his hands deep into the pockets of his coat. Then he smiled, like a cat who had just been entrusted with the keys to a home for wayward but plump canaries. "They say," he said, idly, as if he were simply passing the time, "that Merlin's master, Blaze, once wrote a reel so beguiling that it would charm the coins from the pockets of anyone who heard it." Lear's eyes narrowed. "That'd be worth more than just a timetable," he said, "if you actually had it." The Marquis did a perfectly good impression of someone realizing that, my, it would, wouldn't it? "Well then," he said magnanimously, "I suppose you would have to owe me, wouldn't you?" Lear nodded, reluctantly. He fumbled in his back pocket, pulled out a much-folded scrap of paper, and held it up. The Marquis reached for it. Lear moved his hand away. "Let me hear the reel first, you old trickster," he said, "and it had better work." The Marquis raised an eyebrow. He darted a hand into one of the inside pockets of his coat. When he pulled it out again, it was holding a penny whistle and a small crystal ball. He looked at the crystal ball, made the kind of noise that means, ah, so that's where that went, and put it away again. Then he flexed his fingers, put the penny whistle to his lips, and began to play an odd, rollicking tune that leapt and twisted and sang. It made Richard feel as if he were 13 years old again, listening to his best friend's transistor radio at school in the lunch hour, listening to the top 20 back when pop music had mattered as it only can in your early teenage years. The Marquis' reel was everything he had ever wanted to hear in a song. A handful of coins chinked onto Lear's coat, thrown by passers-by who walked on with a smile on their faces and a spring in their step. The Marquis lowered his penny whistle. "I owe you, then, you old rascal," said Lear, nodding. "Yes, you do." The Marquis took the paper, the timetable, from Lear, and scanned it and nodded. But a word to the wise, don't overuse it. A little goes a very long way." And the four of them walked away, down the long corridor, surrounded by posters advertising films and underwear, and the occasional official-looking notices warning buskers away from the station, listening to the sob of the saxophone and to the sound of money landing on a coat. The Marquis led them to a central line platform. Richard walked over to the edge of the platform and looked down. He wondered, as he always did, which one the live rail was, and decided, as he always did, that it was the one farthest from the platform, with the large, whitish porcelain insulators between it and the ground. And then he found himself smiling, involuntarily, at a tiny dark grey mouse who was bravely prowling the tracks 3 feet below him in a mousy quest for abandoned sandwiches and dropped potato chips. A voice came over the loudspeaker, that formal, disembodied male voice that warned, "Mind the gap." It was intended to keep unwary passengers from stepping into the space between the train and the platform. Richard, like most Londoners, barely heard it anymore. It was like oral wallpaper. But suddenly Hunter's hand was on his arm. "Mind the gap," she said urgently to Richard. "Stand back over there, by the wall." "What?" said Richard. "I said," said Hunter, "mind the..." And then it erupted over the side of the platform. It was diaphanous, dreamlike, a ghost thing, the colour of black smoke, and it welled up like silk underwater, and moving astonishingly fast while still seeming to drift almost in slow motion. It wrapped itself tightly around Richard's ankle. It stung, even through the fabric of his Levi's. The thing pulled him toward the edge of the platform, and he staggered. He realized, as if from a distance, that Hunter had pulled out her staff and was smacking the tentacle with it hard, repeatedly. There was a faraway screaming noise, thin and mindless, like an idiot child deprived of its toy. The smoke tentacle let go of Richard's ankle and slid back over the edge of the platform, and it was gone. Hunter took Richard by the scruff of the neck and pulled him toward the back wall where Richard slumped against it. He was trembling, and the world seemed suddenly utterly unreal. The colour had been sucked from his jeans, wherever the thing had touched him, making them look as if they'd been ineptly tie-dyed. He pulled up the trouser leg. Tiny purple welts were coming up on the skin of his ankle and calf. "What?" he tried to say, but nothing came out. He swallowed and tried again. "What was that?" Hunter looked down at him impassively. Her face could have been carved from brown wood. "I don't think it has a name," she said. "They live in the gaps. I did warn you." "I've never seen one before." "You weren't part of the underside before," said Hunter. "Just wait by the wall. It's safer." The Marquis was checking the time on a large gold pocket watch. He returned it to his waistcoat pocket, consulted the paper Lear had given him, and nodded, satisfied. "We're in luck," he pronounced. "The Earl's Court train should be coming through here in about half an hour." "Earl's Court station isn't on the central line," pointed out Richard. The Marquis stared at Richard, openly amused. "What a refreshing mind you have, young man," he said. "There really is nothing quite like total ignorance, is there?" The warm wind began to blow. An underground train pulled up at the station. People got off, and other people got on, going about the business of their lives, and Richard watched them with envy. "Mind the gap," intoned a recorded voice. "Stand clear of the doors. Mind the gap." Dor took one look at Richard. Then, worried about what she was seeing, she walked over to him and she took his hand. He was very pale, and his breath was coming shallow and fast. "Mind the gap," boomed the recorded voice again. "I'm fine," lied Richard bravely, to no one in particular.